This is The Good Fight with Barbara McGuigan on EWTN Radio. It's all about saints, past, present, and future. You can be a saint too. Listen and learn. Now, here's your host, Barbara McGuigan.
A good day to you and to each of our esteemed listeners. Welcome to The Good Fight. Barbara McGuigan here, alive and grateful to be with you each Saturday to discuss Mother Church's saints and her future saints. In this month of June, we celebrate the Most Holy Trinity, the Most Holy Body and Blood of Christ, the Most Sacred Heart of Jesus, and Father's Day. All exceedingly important days to revere and to celebrate. As Jesus Christ is the perfect man, and as a man never reaches holiness alone, the God-man, knowing all things, lovingly submitted to Saint Joseph, who taught his beloved son a worldly occupation. Saint José María Escrivá explains the importance of a father teaching his son to work. Here's what he said. Joseph loved Jesus as a father loves his son and showed his love by giving him the best he had. Joseph, caring for the child as he had been commanded, made Jesus a craftsman, transmitting his own professional skill to him. It's not possible to ignore this sublime mystery. Jesus, who is man, who speaks with the accent of a particular district of Israel, who resembles a carpenter called Joseph, is the Son of God. And who can teach God anything? But he is also truly man and lives a normal life. First as a child, then as a boy helping in Joseph's workshop, finally as a grown man in the prime of life. Jesus advanced in wisdom and age and grace before God and men. Jesus was fully God, eternally begotten of the Father, and fully man because Saint Joseph formed him as a man. And work was his natural means to do this. Today, in our manly month of June, we have two very special guests, Jason Craig and my producer, Ryan Penny, are with us to talk about the adventure of becoming a man with the ultimate goal, of course, of becoming like Jesus Christ. I'd like to tell you what I know about Jason Craig, a co-founder of Fraternus and author of his new Our Sunday Visitor release called Leaving Boyhood Behind, Reclaiming Catholic Brotherhood. Jason grew up in two homes, sometimes with his mom and sometimes with his dad, but he moved in with his dad full-time at age 12. For a lot of my friends, their father was a blank in their minds, Jason explains. They just were not around. But my dad took me in at a critical age and showed me that fathers love and protect their sons. Later, it made sense to me that God would send his son to save me. Dads do that for their boys. End quote. Jason fell into typical teenage vices, but everything changed after he was mentored by a mature Christian man and led to accept the Christian faith. Jason has been working with youth ever since, after a failed attempt at showing a Catholic friend why Catholicism was nonsense. Jason became a Catholic, along with his future wife, Katie, who grew up in an atheist home. After being received into the church, Jason and Katie entered the world of full-time Catholic ministry. Boy, did we land some big fish here. However, as Jason applied his knowledge and experience of youth ministry at a Catholic parish, he realized that it was the families, especially the fathers, that had the greatest impact. During this time, Jason joined Justin Bianse and Tommy Van Horn in founding Fraternus, and Jason wrote and developed the training and curriculum used this very day around the country. Jason has a master's degree in theology and evangelization from the Augustine Institute and continues his studies and work from a small farm in rural North Carolina. His writings on culture, masculinity, and mentoring have appeared on numerous sites like New Advent, Catholic Exchange, and Those Catholic Men, and he is here today to talk about his new book on rites of passage for Catholic boys, Leaving Boyhood Behind, Reclaiming Catholic Brotherhood. And there's one more thing, I just got to tell you this. He is also known to staunchly defend his family's claim to have invented bourbon. Alrighty then, Jason, a warm welcome to The Good Fight.
Thank you, Barbara. Thank you.
I love how you get that invented bourbon in there. How did that all go about?
Well, I found that out in just the last couple of years when my sort of post-Puritan aunt said very sheepishly, well, you know, you're actually a direct descendant of Elijah Craig who invented bourbon. And if anyone, you know, typically Elijah Craig is a bourbon in your local store of spirits that is about mid-level. I think it should be a little higher, but a little bit of research found out, yeah, that's true. We actually are related to him, and Elijah Craig was my ancestor. He was actually an illegal Baptist preacher in Episcopalian or Anglican Virginia at the time.
And,
my father always says it takes a Craig to think you can make whiskey in a barrel that burned up. So. which is how bourbon is made.
Well, that's good to know. Listen, I've been reading such valuable material on your website, fraternus.net, and you write here, and this is close to my heart as well, you said this is not hyperbole. 40% of children in the United States will be raised without their dad. Considering abuse and the many ways a father can be absent emotionally, spiritually, physically, the ripple effect of a fatherless generation is just beginning. And considering, you said, that the very mission of Jesus was to reveal the face of the Father, and that the turning of fathers' hearts towards their sons is central to God's plan of salvation, and that fathers are meant to image God, we can understand why Joseph Ratzinger, Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI, of course, said, "The crisis of fatherhood we are living today is an element, perhaps the most important, threatening man in his humanity." This is awesome that you have really, you've put your mark on this, and you've got, not only do you establish the problems in this great book, but you have a remedy, and that is what I am so happy, Jason. So congratulations on this great book. I mean it.
Well, thank you. That's very kind of you to say.
Well, it's very true, and you write about your own dad in your masterpiece of a book, Leaving Boyhood Behind. You said that he gave me hard work as a gift. He never coddled me, but you lacked formation, most notably in the higher things. So could you please address, we have a couple minutes before the break, would you please address how God used this experience to give you the impetus to become the Catholic man you are today and to have the inspiration to write Leaving Boyhood Behind?
Right. Well, it has a lot to do with the natural experience that really prepared me for the supernatural life that is our faith. And so when I say, you know, that quote you just read from Ratzinger, which I love, which is he's speaking about if we don't know as humans what a father is, how are we going to know as persons with souls what the Father is, right? So God sort of has created in the order of creation this sort of dependency that we as men reveal what fatherhood looks like. So that when Jesus says, when you pray our Father, that the meaning that's when we say our Father is something beautiful, holy, protective, strong, giving. But all too often, you know, it's really the opposite of those things. When people hear Father, they hear basically an equivalent of tyrant. My experience, I did not grow up in a Catholic home. We didn't even go to any kind of Protestant church or anything like that. But my father loved me as a man, and he had work as his means to show me what sacrifice looked like, what camaraderie looks like, what, you know, being a man of character and your word and just basic virtues. He had means to show me those things in his work. And just so often, men today don't have those things available to them. That's
so
the big crisis that we're facing, that so many men, because in our entire life is, you know, uploaded and virtual and away from the home, us dads, we hear people say, be a good dad. And it's like, great, I hear you, but what do you want me to do? You know, and what's wonderful about my father being somewhat blue collar is he had something to give me in that form, which I think really prepared the ground later for my spiritual life.
Beautiful how God works all that out, isn't it? It's just, you don't even know what's up ahead of you and how great it is, but you just go along, and that's a good thing. Well, you also wrote that today's boys are unfinished, that without fathers and brothers, boys are growing up confused. They're grasping at things they hope will make them a true man, which unfortunately in this culture, it's usually promiscuity, power, popularity, and prestige. The current trends must stop now, you said. And boy, I so totally agree. What must Catholic men do then, Jason, to remedy this crisis of maturity?
Well, we have to recognize it. I mean, it's sort of like Alcoholics Anonymous. If first we have to say, well, what is the problem? And you've mentioned the word a couple times, and the word is tied intimately to the man crisis that, you know, we're discussing here, which is insecurity. You know, being unfinished, meaning we men, it's this sort of paradox. We have this image of that we sort of lift up the self-made man, the man that picks himself up by the bootstraps, which is pure bunk. Every man in his heart wants to hear the same thing that Jesus heard publicly in front of everybody, which is, this is my beloved son in whom I'm well pleased.
Sure.
You know, and then later when the father says, listen to him. We need to have these forms of affirmation in exactly who we are. And when I say that boys are growing up unfinished, it simply means they're not initiated into the ways of men. And they don't feel within their bones that they belong to the world of men, that they are one of them, that they can be secure in that they understand, they have an intelligible way to live their life. A lot of them are saying, no, leave your home. Go find out who you are. Go, you know, be free, which is not freedom. That's a tyranny. And what do young people do when we tell them that? They go try on all kinds of crazy identities, and then they try to find one that sticks. I mean, how many of the groups that we hear about that maybe we're either, you know, unhappy about or happy about, you know, blank community. Well, this community today is protesting this, or that community this, or, you know, all these. What's interesting to me is how often it's community. It's all these little pockets of people saying, look, I found somewhere where I belong. And the great scandal that I've seen in the church, in the Catholic Church, is that boys very rarely begin to grow into manhood and go, man, I belong in the Catholic Church. This is where I can go to be a man.
Mm-hmm. Boy.
They just don't feel that way.
That's so true. And, you know, I've always quoted in my apostolate, Carol Houselander, not sure if you're familiar with her, great London, England writer. Okay. I give talks to women these days now, but she explains, Carol Houselander, that mothers and fathers are raising future men and women, not perpetual adolescents who are afraid of life, of commitments, of marrying and raising a family. I mean, we see this every day. So how does our culture foster immaturity of men who use the term adulting? I mean, I've heard this over and over again, and then I saw it in your book. They use the term adulting when they do something as simple as opening a bank account, as you said. How do you foster immaturity of men? I mean, this is ridiculous what they're doing in this culture.
Right. Well, I mean, we can't foster it within that culture. We have to make the decision to secede from that and say, no, that is not where that is not us. We cannot do that. But I also think, I mean, for someone to say, I'm sorry, I hear music. Are we?
That's okay. That's okay. Actually, you'll finish your thought. Well, just hold on to it.
Okay.
You're listening to The Good Fight, folks, on EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. I'm Barbara McGuigan here with Jason Craig. Stay with us.
This is The Good Fight on EWTN Radio. For more information about The Good Fight, go to EWTN.com and click on Radio. Here again is Barbara McGuigan.
Welcome back to The Good Fight. I'm here with Jason Craig, who has an excellent book. It's called Leaving Boyhood Behind. He's got his finger on the pulse of the male crisis in this country, and it is a crisis. And we were talking about the fact that, as I mentioned, that the culture, this culture we live in, fosters the immaturity of men. And I gave the example of adulting. They called it like they're acting like an adult, and they could probably giggle as they're doing something that is adulting because they're not accustomed, I guess, to be doing these kinds of things. So, Jason, can you just treat that as I rudely interrupted you? Can you just go back to that for a second?
Sure. Oh, no, it wasn't you. It was your producer and that music he played. That, it wasn't you. It was him. Well, I think, thank you, Ryan. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I mentioned the phenomenon of adulting, which is a hashtag used on social media. If I sound somewhat aloof and silly in this, it's because I actually don't have social media. So sometimes I use words in ways that make people laugh, and it makes me laugh that makes them laugh. But the phrase is someone will take a picture of themselves doing a rather normal adult thing, like opening a bank account, and then present it to the world. Look, I'm adulting. You know, I'm being an adult.
Yeah, right.
And these people actually are adults. I mean, they're, you know, 26, 27, 28, or they should be. I think it's just another example, though, of, look, I'm doing this thing. Am I grown up now? You know, can someone affirm
right.
that?
Yeah.
In the case of boys, I mean, boys actually much more, and I talk a lot about this in the book, why boys need rites of passage always, and women and girls don't necessarily, and there's really good reason why that's the case, but boys need to be shown, here's the pathway to masculinity, to true, authentic masculinity. Here's what you do, here's what you don't do, and yes, you're doing it, and you belong. You're doing great. You have what it takes. You are my beloved son, and you, I'm well pleased. You know, that experience. So this whole phenomenon of immaturity is really what the entire book is about, is how we are actually in the world, but also in the church, we're fostering and sort of rewarding immaturity, continuing adolescence as long as possible, especially through college now.
Goodness.
And even in the young adult years. And then somewhat even punishing males when they begin to act like what we would actually want them to act like as
sure.
men. We punish that in boys when they begin to act that way in their younger years, when really we should be rewarding strong, virtuous. Obviously, I'm not talking about silly machismo, chest-beating nonsense, but I am talking about the legitimate exercise of masculine strength, which is obvious to anyone who's still open to using common knowledge, common language, and common sense to look at what it means to be a man.
Boy, so, so true. And I loved how you used the term adolescent Christianity. And when I read on page 27, you gave new stats from a Catholic man crisis fact sheet. Can you go over that? I didn't realize it was that terrible.
Right. Oh, I'll have to open up the book. We have it here. If anyone wanted to find these statistics, they were put together by Matthew Christoph at a website called The New Evangelization. If you do a search for Matthew Christoph, you'll find, you know, I sampled just a few of them. But, you know, here's some. About 11 million adult men in the U.S. were raised Catholic but left the faith. So
gosh.
I just want everyone to know, because sometimes we hear statistics and we go, wow, that's a lot. No, 11 million men have left the faith. And my point, often when I'm quoting what's happening to men, is we typically think of things segmented. But when men leave, boys follow. In fact, when men leave, entire families and households follow. It's very common.
Sure.
55% of men agree that they don't get anything out of Mass. Mm-hmm. So the ones that are there, out of the ones that are still Catholic, over half of them don't really get anything, which means they're being drugged there by grandma or wife or whatever.
Yeah.
Only about a third of Catholic men say they attend Mass on a weekly basis. So, I mean, one of the reasons they very likely don't get anything out of Mass is because they can't, because they're a mortal sin.
Mm.
Let's see, less than half of Catholic men feel that religion is very important in their lives. Just as a comparison, when I was an evangelical Protestant, 74% So 3/4 of men said that basically their faith was important to them. I mean, that's pretty entry level stuff that, you know, your life with the eternal creator and your eternal salvation has some sort of importance in bearing on, you know, day to day things. But those are just the samplings. I mean, you can go on over to Matthew Christoph's site and see an amazing collection. And well, it's a sad collection, but it's eye opening.
But do you think this is because this is the group of men that were receiving nothing but balloons, butterflies, and fluffs? We used to call it fluff. When they, with the breakdown of the Catholic schools and some Catholic schools, and then the uptick of CCD all the time, where that's where they got the balloons, butterflies, and fluff. Is this partially?
Sure.
The,
I mean, one thing that has collapsed and we didn't realize it is the role and the strength of a virtuous and faithful father in the home.
Amen.
So he is. I mean, statistically, and I know this isn't, you know, popular things to say, but it's true. I mean, if we just look statistically, and we in the church should not speak in coded PC language, we should speak the truth in love, but truly, and that is that fathers lead families. And when fathers go to, and they're faithful to their faith, then their family is faithful. When they leave and they walk out the door, well, their family follows them there too. The father leads the family. This is overwhelmingly obvious to anyone who's either read the statistics or looked around at Mass. And just being the very obvious case of families. The one thing, when back in the day, when you were able to drop your kid off at CCD, because basically the catechist was able to just confirm what you know your father already believes and, you know, give you some catechism and give you the theological formulations that are beautiful and precise that the church offers us. But really, that's a very tiny piece of true, authentic formation. So as fatherhood was collapsing, the church at the same time, simultaneously, was getting very silly in her formation of, and we get the balloons and the felt banners and all that stuff, which
so
we laugh at. But in the case of boys, let me tell you what that effect is. They start, you know, they're 12, 13, 14, 15, their voice is cracking, their biceps are getting bigger, they're getting a little hairier. They kind of want to be with men, and then they get dropped off at church. They're in a co-ed environment where an overwhelming 80% of those that lead parish ministries are women. So people are talking about, you know, we need women in leadership roles. I'm like, actually, can we get a few men?
Really?
So 80% of women make up catechists. So the boys are going to this, and they see children, and they see women, and they see no men. So they go, oh, to become a man, I've got to leave this. I mean, and there's a logic to their thought process, and statistically, and in everyone's experience, that's what's happening. They get drug along. Maybe we extend confirmation prep or you know, maybe we keep raising the age of confirmation, which is a strategy that has never worked, and we should stop doing it.
Right.
And but the boys, they look around and they go, "Oh, the church is where women and children go. I got to get out of here, you know, because I want to be a man.
Be. Right.
I want to be a man." And then sometimes you get the opposite. You get the boy that can spout off every catechism answers, and he loves to get patted on the head by the church ladies. And but really, he becomes intolerable to your average Catholic male who kind of looks on him with a little bit of disdain and annoyance for good reason, because no one wants a mama's boy. We need men of virtue, not boys trying to get a pat on the head for the right answer.
You know, oh, I so agree with you. I mean, many moons ago, I taught the confirmation classes at my parish, and I would just cringe every time we had to go on a retreat, because we always had to open with these, I call them inane icebreakers. Lot of pablum, open forums where the teenagers would get up there and rag on their parents, you know, and it became like a soap opera. And then you would have these high schoolers that they're being taught to do this on a retreat, for God's sake. And then, like you say in the book, and I so related, you quoted how you're falling in love with God's sermons. We had all this Jesus is our friend, you know, this. But here's what you brought up that I thought was so clever. You said this kind of preaching results in puppy love faith that can promote a culture of spiritual immaturity. And I remember in Ireland, I was speaking over there, and a priest once told me, he said, the kids today learn nothing in high school, and then they discuss it in college. So you asked the question, the important question, how can we bring men out of immaturity and into maturity? So how do we?
Right. Well, I mean, I hate to sound, we'll read the book and we'll discuss it. But, I mean, for your listeners out there, you've read it. But, I mean, that really is the entire point of the book, is how exactly do we bring them out of immaturity and initiate them into maturity, which we can talk about after the break.
We will certainly do that. God bless you. You're listening to The Good Fight on EWTN Radio. Stay with us. You're going to love it.
This is The Good Fight on EWTN Radio. For more information about The Good Fight, go to EWTN.com and click on Radio. Here again is Barbara McGuigan.
Welcome back to The Good Fight, and I am here with Leaving Boyhood Behind, Jason M. Craig. And it's a wonderful book, and I know that EWTN Religious Catalog carries this book. So if you, it would be a great book for any man, but particularly for fathers and their sons. Honestly, it will change the culture. If this could just, Jason, I'm sure you probably lay in bed at night and you think about this, how if everyone just embraced what you are trying to do, and you've got plenty of people who are already involved in the group called Fraternus, the brotherhood group called Fraternus. Can you talk a bit about Fraternus, and then we'll get into that whole rite of passage thing?
Sure. Well, a lot of what the book is reflecting on my experience in Fraternus, but also sort of the research. I've been kind of fascinated with the idea of, you know, what has happened to man? What can we do practically? I mean, you know, part of that fascination, I lay in bed at night thinking, I hope that heifer doesn't get out again, because we live on a little dairy farm. So
That's great. It keeps
me distracted. When you have a pasture to get bush hogged or get hay, then you don't have to think about the world's problems. You just have to think about grass, which is much better.
That's beautiful. I love it.
The experience of Fraternus was largely, you know, I was involved with youth ministry, sort of expert, you know, and especially from a Protestant perspective, kind of get in there, save the youth, save the day, big conferences, big retreats, you know, big youth group, discipleship, this, all. And then we did Fraternus, and it was like these goofy adult, middle-aged and older men being really, really effective at bringing boys into maturity. And it's like, why is that working? That doesn't seem, these guys came and throw a Frisbee, look at them, you know? and so a lot of the book is actually trying to digest, well, how is it that boys actually grow into men? And what's really essential in that process? And then really discovering sort of the anthropological concept. I mean, anthropology is the study of man.
Right.
Is the concept of a rite of passage is sort of just, it's not a formula. It's actually an observation where we get this idea of, this is how cultures make sure that their boys don't stay boys, but actually become men inside of their culture, you know, and their living and breathing culture. So the book is both a reflection on the experience of Fraternus, but also, you know, I guess sort of the scholarly side is not just, let's just not come up with new formulas, because it's like we've been trying on different ideas for so long catechetically, and none of them work. It's really kind of time to get back to some real basics.
Yes.
Which is what I think framing the concept of the man crisis and the boy crisis, because they're always related, and the immaturity crisis, framing that within what a rite of passage is, helps us not only understand what's going wrong, but then in the same breath helps us to see what we need to do.
Yes. Yes. Well, you define the rite of passage, and then you explain the three distinct parts in any rite of passage. I thought this was so interesting. And it this whole thing applies to what you do with the boys, yes?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
So let's just talk about what a rite of passage is so that we can get out of our head anything that's silly.
Okay.
First of all, the phrase is coined by an anthropologist named Arnold von Gennep, and what he was observing was how cultures and societies all over the world and throughout time, how they go about helping someone to go from one state of life to a new state of life that is different. So the reason you would need an initiation, a rite of passage, is when you want to sort of, you want to go over there, you know,
yeah,
to that spot across the water. The rite of passage is the bridge, but those two places are not the same places. So they're conflicting ways of life. You can't be both of these things at the same time. You're either that or this. You're in or you're out. So the most common example that most people understand, and this is truly a rite of passage, is marriage. You cannot be a single man and a married man at the same time.
Right.
And if a single man acts married, he sins and hurts other people. And when a married man acts single, he sins and hurts other people, right? You need to have a way where the culture around you recognizes, and you within yourself and the new body that's created, i.e. you and your wife, where you recognize something has changed. You know, these two things, they don't, you know, these they don't exist anymore. And St. Paul uses the same language for becoming a Christian, that you cannot be the old man and the new man at the same time. And anytime that that new man creeps up, you got to get rid of him. Right. Which
yes.
is why the church actually uses the language of initiation to talk about our conversion to Christ. That's actually her language, is, you know, the sacraments of initiation are the first three sacraments.
Yeah.
But before we talk about that, I think it's interesting to talk about what Gnep said makes up a rite of passage, because most of us, when we hear that, we think, you know, a boy going out to kill a lion in some African tribe somewhere, which is sort of a sensational kind of Hollywood vision of what it means.
Okay.
All societies had this. But so set aside the sensational boy thing and think, just broadly speaking, the rite of passage, you know, like a man becoming married, for example. The three things that must happen, the first one is his old life has to die. I mean, it has to be put behind him, has to be totally set aside, severed from his old way of life. Because you can't go to that island over there if you're still standing on the shore here. It doesn't work. You gotta step off that shore. The second stage is a confirmation and a recognition of, and sort of an introduction of, that new way of life. So we would talk with Von Gnep would call that the transition stage, or the actual, you know, this is the moment of initiation, i.e. this is the wedding, you know.
Yeah.
This
okay.
is the bridge. The wedding is the bridge, right?
Yes.
Where this
yeah.
was the moment. I came into this church single and I left married. You know, that's the second stage. So when I walked through those doors, I left behind a life I'm never going back to. And then in this moment, the two became one flesh, right?
Right.
And then the other side, the third stage, is incorporation, meaning comes from the Latin in corpus, to be brought into a new body. So almost all initiations are actually a form of joining a body, not of just changing your own outlook on things. But on the other side of initiation, you left behind something that you were individually, but that you personally left behind. And on the other side of it, you join a new body. So the two, you know, as Jesus says, we're talking about, we're quoting Genesis, for this reason, a man must leave, be separated from
yep.
his family, his mother and father, be joined to his wife, so the initiation, the wedding, and the two shall become one flesh, in corpus, one body, a new corporate bodily reality.
Beautiful.
So in the church, you know, our sacraments of initiation follow this pattern exactly.
Great analogy.
Baptism is the death of the old man. It's the death of the old man. Confirmation is the introduction to his new identity, which is the beautiful custom of even getting a new name. This is how radical this is.
Yeah,
and then the church actually uses the language of communion, the Eucharist, the final. By the way, this is the actual last sacrament of initiation, not confirmation. It's the Eucharist. We do it out of order with our kids for some reason. There's good reasons. There's historical reasons. I think we should change it. But anyway, the Eucharist is the incorporation of that person into the whole body of Christ. So when you receive communion, you can never do that in isolation, or you haven't received communion. In fact, if you receive communion in isolation, what that is a sacrilege, because you're either excommunicated or in mortal sin, right? You're severed from the body. So to receive the Eucharist worthily in grace is to be incorporated into the whole body, which is the language that the Catechism uses to describe what happens. So, you know, you didn't achieve something in the Eucharist, you're being brought into a heavenly and earthly reality in the church, in communion. So that is how initiation occurs. But what's interesting is that one little aspect of von Ganep's study is, oh, this is how cultures did this with boys, meaning there is something so distinct between boyhood and manhood
yes.
that it requires a rite of passage. So the island over there, that's where the men live. You know, if I want to get over there, I have to go through a rite of passage. And it's so different from being a boy that it's not just that these are two different words. They're actually two totally different ways of living, which is very helpful when you ask the questions about immaturity. It's just to recognize, first of all, I mean, you know, one, men aren't women. So there's a distinction there. And boys aren't men. So that distinction is there. Okay, if boys aren't men, then how do we bring them into manhood, right? How do we make that happen? So if we define our man crisis as a crisis of immaturity, then to recognize how we do something about it, that's why the entirety of this book is framed and the chapters are framed in those three stages of separation, initiation, and incorporation. In the case of how this occurs with boys, you know, becoming men, what is occurring, the first stage, the boyhood has to die. He has to be severed from that life. Then he has to be initiated, meaning have come to grips with the experience and the reality and the identity of being a man. Because remember, he's been a boy his whole life. He's never been a man. It's something new.
That's all he knows. Yeah.
He's got to be introduced to it. And then the last stage is that he's incorporated into a brotherhood of men, where the other men recognize he's one of us, and that boy has ways to know and hear the words, I'm one of them, and he can say that with confidence. That's what it means to be secure. That you know, security is not that you have gained massive self-confidence that allows you to walk in any room like you're the boss. That's called arrogance. That's not confidence. That's arrogance.
Mm-hmm.
Confidence is when a man knows who he is. He's got nothing to prove to anyone. And the reason he has nothing to prove to anyone is because he knows who he is because of the body of men that he belongs to. This is why there's an amazing... Sorry, go ahead.
No, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I think that the point that is so good is, as you wrote, fatherless boys cannot make it on their own. We're expecting these boys to go to manhood isolated and by themselves. And so if their mothers can't do this, but they need fathers or fatherly mentors to fill the void. So the whole idea is, maturity, you say, and I think this is so wise, maturity is begotten, not made. This is perfect. They need to have a father or a fatherly mentor, would you say? This is such a wise, important statement.
Right. I think, you know, to draw your attention, in the book we talk about Jesus' rite of passage, which he, he would have had one culturally as a Jewish man, you know, just as St. Paul says, you know, when I was a boy, I acted like a boy. When I became a man, I did stuff men do, i.e. I was initiated. And my culture gave me, hey, these are things boys do and these are things men do. You know, we don't do that today. We don't say, no, you cannot play video games for 4 hours every night and be a good father. No, you just can't do that. Sorry. But I really like them. No, get over it. You know, St. Paul had that and Jesus had it. And an interesting thing in the Gospels that I found in researching Jesus becoming a man is that there's two instances where Mary keeps these things in her heart. One is when she sort of receives the baby Jesus, the infancy at the incarnation. She kept these things in her heart. She pondered them. The second time, that same idea is repeated by St. Luke, is after the incident where Jesus is in the temple, where he's lost in the temple, where he's separated from his father and mother, brings out his identity, i.e., I must be about my father's business, and he's amongst the men in the temple, teaching and preaching, sort of doing what he will do later as a man, his ultimate mission. Now, he goes back for a while to be a carpenter, a man in the world that, you know, men like me, we can relate to that. It's beautiful. But also, this is what I'm going to be my father's business. I'm going to be wrapped up in the life of the temple, the men that are in the temple. This is going to be important later. But after that, Mary ponders these things in her heart. So she receives Jesus as an infant, but she also ponders and receives him as a man, because those are two different births. And so men are begotten, not made. They're born, which is why when adolescence comes to an end, it needs to die. It needs to be killed so that the man can be born. And he's born into a world of other men. It's a whole new life. You know, the beasts of the earth, once they reach maturity, i.e. they can mate, that's it. You know, there's not much, there's no further go, you know, there's no further journey for them. That's kind of, you know, that's the peak of their existence. Whereas for men, once we reach that point, there's actually a whole new world that opens up, which is, yeah, I'm going to, now that I'm a man, what is my life going to be? And that's sort of the trajectory that we go through this life in the natural sense, but on into eternity, which is why St. Paul says, you know, very often in different ways, I wish you guys would grow up. Meaning, you know, I want to talk about the red meat of truth, and you're still drinking milk. You know, you're still spiritual babies.
Yeah.
And he says to the Ephesians, I want you to grow into the full, mature manhood of Jesus Christ. He says other places, I want you to stop thinking like a child. He says, I want you to be innocent like a child, but I don't want you to actually think like one. So when Jesus, you know, says, I want you to be like these little children, he's talking about their innocence, not their thought process. Because children don't think in the ways that men must think. How will I provide, protect, and guard my family? How will I love my wife? These are things that my sons have no concern over, because they shouldn't. They're boys.
Right.
But one day they're going to need to be concerned about those things. And I want men around them, because I can, you know, we talk about fatherless boys, how crippled they are because they don't have men to show them. But you know what? I'm not enough either. There has to be a community of men around me. So those fathers that think just by pure rigor and their own example and, you know, the Baltimore Catechism that they're going to have everything within their conclave of a home, that's not going to work either, bud. I'm sorry.
You need
You've
the brotherhood.
You've got to have a community of men around you. Yeah.
You need the brotherhood.
Absolutely.
Wow. But this is what I love that you brought out. When you talked about Jesus, the perfect man, he transitioned out of childhood to embrace his future mission. He was concerned with the larger meaning of life. And this is what I believe in this culture. There's so many boys and young men who totally miss the boat on this. They want to do all the manly things, right? But they want to remain a child with no higher goal, because you make the point that the whole idea of a boy becoming a man is so he can return back to the family, right? To his wife and kids.
Right.
That's, gosh.
Absolutely.
I mean,
yeah.
How many people have never even heard this before, Jason?
Well, what's funny is they hear, even in, our, you know, even in, you know, perhaps media circles that would be thinking I am just spouting the worst heresy ever, according to secular standards. They still report on these things with a little tongue in cheek, like, hey, look at all the, like, the men or guys or young adults, whatever we want to call them. We kind of want to call them anything but men, because there's something. Look at how many of them are going to live with their parents after college. You know, we sort of look at that and go, something's going on here. Now, there are legitimate reasons to live in an intergenerational household. Can I just make sure I throw that out there?
Yeah.
But there's a lot of men that actually, the reason they're still at home is because they're still boys. And they're unwilling. And honestly, they might be, they got a decent job. They don't have to pay rent. Maybe they share a grocery bill. And they've got, you know, to get into more sultry topics, you know, they've got pornography, so they don't need a wife. They've got video games, so they don't really need to go out and, you know, like, have adventures. They've got them right there on the screen. They've got, you know, so-called friends on social media. They're kind of pretty happy in this simulated world in mom's basement. And you just mentioned the truth, which is the reason you've got to be cut off from your childhood household is that if you live there, you will act like you always have acted there, which is a boy. And the men out there, how many of you, if you're listening, you go home in college, what does mom want to do? She wants to do your laundry, right? So, and then you go home, and you've been a man, you've had all these adventures, and all of a sudden you go home and you're like, why am I feeling these weird feelings that I felt as a boy? I'm kind of acting like a boy, and I'm laying around and sort of waiting for people to wait on me. And, you know, that happens to us because well, that's how we acted when we lived there. But then there's something repulsive about when a man goes by and he still acts that way. So being severed from that.
Yeah.
And then he has his sort of initiation into brotherliness and to being a man. Then he's able to be reintegrated into the domestic life, but not as a child, as a father. Right. And his life has changed because, yes, he's back in the home. He's domesticated. You know, he goes out and maybe he has an adventure, but that doesn't mean he's not domestic. He's
right.
Brought back into the life of the home, but not as a boy, not as a passive person, but as a leader, as a father,
yeah.
Right? But if he doesn't leave home, he doesn't leave home in his heart or physically, then how's he going to live as a man and as a father in his household? Well, he's not. He's not going to.
No. I mean, you look at so many of these young men today, and if you followed them home, you would see that their fathers act like boys and want boy
right.
toys and things like that. It not across the board, of course, but, I mean, I think it's becoming, like you say, it's the beginning of a crisis, a boy and man
right.
crisis.
It's always an intergenerational problem. You cannot... Men have such a heavy influence upon one another. I mean, we like
sure.
to pretend that we like to pretend we're autonomous, self-fulfilling beings, which, you know, you're not a god, so get over yourself. But the truth is we actually always take our cues and sort of flow out and flow back in towards the men and the men around us. Or, you know, and if they're not there, then we do truly become self-absorbed, narcissist, or effeminate. And in the case of us men, this problem that you might see, well, there's a boy playing a video game, then his son, then his father. Yeah, I'm sorry I keep picking on video games. It's just a very common problem. But this problem will always be intergenerational because we men are imitators. We don't invent new ways of living. Very often we just kind of pick up ways. And when... Mm-hmm. That's a healthy society, then the boys pick up, you know, healthy ways of life. But when a father, see, we understand ourselves as men in relationship to other people. So when I see and look in the eyes of my son, in that relationship, I understand myself to be a father. It changes the way I approach
Absolutely.
All of my life by
yeah.
being a father.
Yeah.
And when he looks at me and is a son and he's confident in his sonship, the way he approaches life is different, which is why childless
yes.
men and fatherless boys are sort of mirroring of the same problem. So when childless men, you know, when men don't become fathers, something happens to them. When they don't learn how to give themselves in a paternal
yeah.
way,
yeah.
something happens and keeps them in immaturity. And when a son is unable to look in a filial way towards his father, then he gets stuck in his immaturity, and this problem compounds. So we actually have a magazine. We publish it for the men of Fraternus, but it's open to all men. They can subscribe. It's called Sword and Spade. And that was our first, and I think will be continuing to be our most popular issue, which is the childless epidemic. You know, we talk about
yes.
fatherlessness. Like,
yep.
what about all the men? Presumably, for every boy that's fatherless, there's a man somewhere out there who's childless. He's not being a good dad. So what's mm-hmm. the effect on him? You know,
yeah.
we talk about fatherlessness and the effect on the child. Well, what about that man? What is
yes.
it, what does it mean to turn away from the vocation you were called to, i.e. being paternal, being a father? What happens to you when you fail to enter into that role of being a good dad, of being a father? What happens?
You know,
so that was our first issue, and it was very interesting how popular it was.
And I can imagine, because, you know, so many, we've had a lot of weddings lately in our family. We have a big family, not my immediate family, but that too. But, you know, they're waiting 2, 3, 4 years before they even have a baby. And I think it's such a
right.
sad thing. First of all, they don't even know if God's going to give them a baby, right? But secondly,
right.
it's they live like married singles. They haven't changed a thing. They haven't entered their vocation at all, really. They're living just as if they were dating. And I think it's so sad to think that they are what God has intended to bring them so much joy and confidence and security, they just kind of walk away. It's really, really
yeah.
sad, I think. And I don't think people realize what's going on with this. What do you think?
Yeah, they're playing house.
Yes,
game,
exactly.
Which is what children do.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just another sign of immaturity. I mean, this great. You're renovating your home and you're taking pictures of yourself and showing it to all your friends, but you're not having children. And that is the first end of marriage, according to the church, but also according to the natural reason that when men and women come together and they have this lifelong bond, the obvious purpose, the obvious and natural purpose, this is natural law here. You don't have to be faithful Catholic to agree with this. Yeah, the end is children. And obviously so to mature in marriage is to have children, and people think, well, that we got to let that happen late. But the reality, I mean, my wife and I, we were told, we were in an NFP class, we were told, don't abstain. It turned out we were infertile for 2 years.
See, you just don't know. Hold on to that thought, Jason. We're going to come back for another 15 minutes with Jason Craig. He's the author of Leaving Boyhood Behind. Honestly, it's a barn burner of a book. And if everyone picked this up and read it sincerely, they would want to jump into action right here to get active about this whole crisis that we are involved in, the man crisis, which is also a boy crisis. You're listening to The Good Fight. And I hope you come back for the next hour. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to The Good Fight on EWTN Radio. Here again is Barbara McGuigan.
Welcome back to round two of The Good Fight. The fight is on, and we'll continue our interview with Jason M. Craig, C-R-A-I-G. And what I just found out that I didn't know previously to this is that the book, Leaving Boyhood Behind, is Jason's book, but it also comes with a DVD. I didn't know. And so if you want the SKU number, item number, whatever you want to call it, it's T, as in Tom, 1959K. T1959K. And of course, you know EWTNRC.com. So the book and the DVD come together. So this is just excellent, just excellent. And Jason, I'm just so proud that you do this. I mean, you are a treasure, Mother Church. We've got 15 more minutes, and I want to get in. I think I mentioned to you that we are the parents, my husband and I, have only one son and three daughters. And we offered our children the option, right, as I think a lot of parents do, to choose from our list, right, of solid, highly recommended, stellar Catholic universities, which they did. The separation for me, when I think about my girls going off, it was not really very difficult. I mean, I knew I would miss them, but when my son went off to the University of Dallas, and I was so proud of him, but inside, I was crushed like pineapple. I'll probably never get over it. So I'm happy it turned into a very wonderful experience for all of us, and it still is. He met the most wonderful friends that he still has. Still sees just great, great people, men, you know, all men. But you write about the hero's journey, and this is the process of separation from the boyhood home in order to return as a man, and he did. Can you go to that, the hero's journey, please?
Sure. Well, I think we can still frame it. I mean, the hero's journey is kind of a retelling of, in the language of sort of myth and literary characters, of what a rite of passage does, that sort of separation from, you know, your household or your childhood, and then your adventure and initiation and sort of revealing of what you're made of, and and then returning home, coming back.
Okay.
So what you're mentioning there is a fascinating thing when I got to this book is, you know, the separation from boyhood, that part of an initiation that, you know, you leave that, where you leave your boyhood behind, the name of the book.
Yeah.
The hardest part of it, you know, people ask, like, well, what's the, you know, a lot of people want to talk about what's the experience that the boys are going to do? Let's go, you know, elk hunting or something. Okay, you know, that's easy.
Right.
The hard thing for us is actually step one, which is getting mom to let go. In fact, I would describe I would describe our culture. You know, we talk about, you know, the patriarchy and all that stuff, which is fascinating to me because really we live in a very matriarchal time in history, meaning
we do
the maternal and the motherliness that surrounds boyhood, by the way, which is good. Boys need to belong to their mother. I think you and I were discussing, or maybe you put it in your email, that it's fascinating that boys are actually less secure when they have a less secure bond with their mother in their childhood.
Right.
Right. They need the stronger that bond is with their mother, the better they are. The better they are as they become men.
I love it.
But the so it's good. It's like because we think, well, gosh, we need these men and fatherless boys. Got it, you know. And all. Well, it's like, what about the moms? It's like, actually, mom, if you don't bond with your boy and his when he's young, it's harder for him to grow into a man later. So,
I love it.
Yes, we need the manliness. We need the manliness of fathers, right? But we need the tenderness, the gentleness of mothers. That's how we get gentle men, right? We've got the mother and the father are part of it. But what we live, what we're living right now is that moms are not letting go. Moms, and even and especially in the Catholic world, the maternal, the matriarchal, the womanly grasp on men and boys is actually debilitating. That if a mother does not let go,
that's right,
then the boy cannot become a man. Which is, you know, there's kind of these jokes about cut the apron strings, or, you know, maybe more bluntly, cut that umbilical cord.
Right.
You know, that if the mom doesn't let go, it's a problem. And the reason moms don't let go is you just described it within your own experience, which is there is a unique and special bond between mother and son. You know, it says in the Gospels that Mary keeps these things in her heart, you know?
Yes.
What was interesting to me, one study I found that mothers actually keep, for whatever biological, you know, reasons, mothers actually have the DNA of their sons in their brains and their hearts. So there's not daughters. Not daughters.
Seriously?
Only their sons. The DNA, yes. The DNA, it's in the book. Get the book, people. Unless they edited it out and I didn't notice. But no, I think it's in there.
I'm looking for it. I didn't read that.
Maybe it's in a footnote.
Oh, yeah, wait a minute. DNA no. It is here. It is here. Yes. You say,
That's right,
identity bond
the DNA's
of mother.
There. So you have this bond with your son, which is, and one funny thing that happened is I was writing this book. I came down to my mailbox and my neighbor was there, and a mother of her boy, and her son had just got married, and she was a total mess. And she kept saying, but I like her. I really like her, which I wasn't bringing anything up about the bride, but she was weeping because her son just got married.
No.
And this, what it was a similar moment of like what you had where your boy left you.
Oh,
that
God.
In order for him, in order for him to become a man, he has to leave you.
Amen.
And not only that, in the case of this woman at the mailbox, his mother at the mailbox, not only did he leave her, but then he replaced her with this woman, you know, his wife.
The nerve,
which is why, and there's probably listeners out there, there's this kind of like cliche battle between, you know, mother-in-law and daughter-in-law, and this poor son is in the middle. And the reason is because for that boy and for that mother, they're sort of everything to each other. You know, there's this beautiful bond.
Yes.
But then the bond gets severed. And then even worse, he gets a new feminine, you know, in his life. And the mom gets mad. And if she hasn't truly let go, she actually causes division within the marriage. It can be a huge problem.
Oh, that's so not good.
I
prayed,
problem.
Jason. I prayed for a beautiful spouse for him, a holy woman, and boy, did he get one. We got to pray.
Well, you let go then. So that's the thing. The difference is it was hard for you when he went off to college. And my point is that's why the chapter is, you know, a mother's joy and a mother's sorrow. It's interesting to me, you know, in the book, I talk about that Jesus being lost in the temple is sort of the moment Jesus became, you know, associated with his father's business, i.e. he became a man. You know, he sort of left the lap of his mother and now associates with his future mission, which is away from her and at the cross. It doesn't mean he doesn't love or respect her anymore. It just means he is now associated with the father's will. There's a certain separation.
Right.
you know, it, that has to occur. But what's fascinating in Catholic piety, that's both a joyful mystery in the rosary,
yes. Yes.
But in the seven sorrows of Mary, it's a sorrowful mystery.
Sorrowful mystery, right?
So,
right.
Yeah, the same instance, depending on how you're meditating on that, it's either really, really sad or really, really joyful. And for women, when their son becomes a man,
yes.
It's really sad because he will never be a man and still be overly attached to her. There's no such thing as a mama's man. If he's attached to her, he's a mama's boy.
And right? It's sad. You I mean, that, it's really sad,
it's
too,
sad.
I think.
It is, yes. Yeah.
Because
yes.
they won't be fulfilled as
well,
they should
sorrow.
Be.
It's a sorrow. I mean, you know, this is actually a sad thing because, you know, I quote some mom bloggers in the book because they say it best. They're like, they fall in love the most at like 9, 10, 11. Their boy is like their treasure.
Yep.
And then all of a sudden, 12, 13, 14, 15, he's kind of a jerk. And what happened? You know?
Right.
And like, we're tense and we're arguing and what in the world? And it's because he's becoming a man. He's not, you know, your daughter is going to become more like you. You guys are going to kind of become friends. Your son becomes unlike you. And you don't want him to be like you because you're a woman. You want
exactly.
to be a man.
Exactly. And we see what that has led to, this all the effeminacy and, oh, God help us. I mean, this poor culture. I mean, it's just going into the – yeah. I always think every day, well, we hit the bottom of the birdcage today, right? And then I'll read something else the next day, and I'm going, we're still at the bottom of the birdcage. But I love how you put this. You said all boys need the motherly release and the fatherly embrace during their journey to manhood. That says it all right there, don't you think?
Absolutely. I mean, that's what occurs. You know, it was a terrible thing that my home was divided by divorce, you know, that there was two houses. That is not God's plan for man.
Right.
One of the ways that grace was able to, you know, sort of build on an imperfect yet natural occurrence, though, was that, and this was a big epiphany for me as I was researching the book and reading Jesus' own entrance into manhood was, you know, that phrase, I must be about my father's business.
Yes.
You know, I, at age 12, which is really the traditional age of a rite of passage, because in most societies, you want to end boyhood and adolescence as soon as possible. I mean, we keep extending it. But really, they did it, you know, close to age 12 and 13. These boys, you know, an Amish boy at 13 is out running a team of horses. He's doing what men do because it's a whole lot better than trying to keep them in the house all day. Or worse, under fluorescent lights in 10 hours a day in a classroom. It's not the worst place you can put a boy at age 13.
Yeah.
Anyway, as I was reading and researching this, it was fascinating for me. When I was 12, there was this realization kind of amongst the family. There were some tensions where I was staying with my mother, there, you know, all these things. And it was very imperfect. But there's this realization, man, Jason needs to go live with his dad right now, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it was absolutely true that at that time in my life, I needed to be about my father's business. And
yes. My
father's business, he was a plumber. So, you know, I loved my, there's a great intellectual tradition in my family. My grandfather was a renowned scientist. This is great. But my father's a plumber, and I love that because I think in this day and age, having that skill, that beautiful kind of tradition of manliness that we had something to do, I must be about my father's business, was great. Actually, when I get off this interview, a little side note, my grandfather was a scientist, but he worked with his hands and built houses on the side, which I know sounds crazy now, which was probably crazy then. but he taught my father and all the grandkids and cousins through these sort of working ways. And he had this little Toyota pickup that he would teach everyone to drive a stick in. And there was one for sale about a quarter mile from me. And I'm going to buy that sucker as soon as this interview is over, because that is the exact truck that my grandfather used. I mean, not the precise one, although it could be because it was stolen from us, but it's likely not. Anyway, I'm going to go buy it. And having that tradition in our family to say, this is the type of truck that men in our family have learned how to drive a stick in. Being able to have that for my sons is much better than trying to give them masculinity as some sort of information, some sort of data, as if I could give a PowerPoint about how to be a man. Nope.
Oh.
Son, I love you. Have what it takes. And this is first gear, right? And, you know, you got to let the clutch out easy. And, And now we're going to go into second gear. You hear how the motor wants to go somewhere? Well, it wants to go to second gear. That's where we're going to go. And, you know, one day you're going to have to kick it into second gear, son, and get out of this house. But not now. You're only nine. And don't worry. I live in the country. I live in the country, so we're allowed to let nine-year-olds drive.
Okay. Yes, you can. Okay. That's for sure. Yeah. My parents lived on a ranch, too, so we knew that. Jason, we're down to the wire here, and I just want to say it was such a gift to have you on The Good Fight today. Thanks ever so much. I know you're busy, and I appreciate it so much. And I just want to say, may our gracious God continue to bless you and yours abundantly for your faith, for your love, and for your generosity that you show to all of his children, especially his boys and men. I'm so thrilled with you, and I want you to come back. We have a lot more to talk about, so I'm going to send you some dates and pray that you can fit us in for another hour at least. And so God keep you, good man. I am so thankful for you.
Thank you, Barbara. It's been a lot of fun talking to you.
Oh, listen, you have such a good thing going. You have such a good thing going. You're listening to The Good Fight, folks, on EWTN, Global Catholic Radio Network. I'm Barbara McGuigan here with Leaving Boyhood Behind, Jason M. Craig, the author of Leaving Boyhood Behind. And next, we will have someone else. I'll need a drum roll for this young man who happens to be my new producer, but also connected with Fraternus.
This is The Good Fight on EWTN Radio. For more information about The Good Fight, go to EWTN.com and click on radio. Here again is Barbara McGuigan.
Welcome back to The Good Fight, and I need a drum roll right now for a wonderful young man who happens to be my new producer for The Good Fight. His name is Ryan Penny, and I always say he's worth a million. He is the associate producer and call screener for EWTN Radio. You've also seen him co-hosting EWTN's Religious Catalog show. He graduated from Samford University in Birmingham, Alabama in 2014, worked for a couple of years in college campus ministry, and has worked for EWTN since 2016. He has been heavily involved in the genesis and leadership of the Birmingham chapter of Fraternus, which is the brotherhood group we talked about in the last hour with Jason. And he is now the program director and MC for Fraternus Ranch. And that's the annual summer high adventure camp, which hosts hundreds of Fraternus brothers from all over the country. Ryan has spoken to numerous youth groups and young adults about his testimony and various aspects of living the Christian faith, but he has not always been committed to following Christ. Ryan has loved performing all his life. He sang and danced competitively through school and was awarded a performing arts scholarship to Samford University in Birmingham. His dream was to act on Broadway. Well, on a summer day after his freshman year, that dream was shattered in a tragic accident that left him severely injured. So we're going to talk about that today, and he is here to share his story of how it was only after this life-altering event that he realized that true happiness and fulfillment cannot be achieved without union with Christ and his kingdom, and the crucial role that Fraternus has played in allowing him to follow Christ the King. So it's going to be a beautiful interview. Ryan, welcome to The Good Fight.
Hi, Barbara.
Listen here. We've never done this before, and I'm just tickled to do it. You've only told me a few stories about yourself because you haven't been producing for The Good Fight that long, but they were powerful stories, and I believe that this is the way God can take something terrible and turn it into something beautiful. And I believe that what you did have to go through made you the Catholic man that you've proven to be. So can you tell the folks all about your story?
Well, sure. I mean, first I must say, you say I've only been producing this show for not very long. I guess I've been producing it for 3 months now.
Right.
And I would say that I've gotten to produce this show for the past 3 months, and I would say that it's been an enormous privilege and a blessing, because of all of the amazing stories that I've gotten to hear on this show every week. I mean, yes. You just are able to amass a tremendous entourage of holy people,
God is good.
In whose lives God has done amazing and done things on a biblical scale, literally, in their lives. It's pretty amazing. These amazing
praise
men
God.
And women. And so it's a great thing to be able to hear that every week. And I certainly am able to, you know, they talk about certain things. I'm like, I can resonate with that. I can resonate with that. I know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
And thankfully I can, and that I get to, you know, be doing it here at EWTN. Cause I think in a way my story begins with EWTN because it starts with my mother.
No.
And, you know, Jason was talking all in the last hour about the important role of mothers,
right.
and that how the boy has to separate from the mother. But at first, it's this crucial formation that takes place, and it really goes back to Mother Angelica in a way, Barbara, because my mom grew up in a big Catholic family. She's one of seven children. Mm-hmm. Big Catholic family up in she. Grew up in Framingham, Massachusetts, so not far from Boston. Good old Northeastern Catholic family, right? So in the early 1960s, everybody went to church on Sunday, and almost everybody was Catholic, so going to church on Sunday is just what you did. And and so my mom really grew up not really knowing a lot about her faith until she went off to college. And she actually went to the University of Alabama down here in Tuscaloosa, and she never darkened the doors of a Catholic church a single time, her whole college experience, you know. And it wasn't until she moved back up to Nashville and she met a holy Catholic priest who had like a Catholicism 101 class. And I think there are many people listening who might know who this is, Father Fleming, who is very instrumental in the new construction of the cathedral in Nashville, Tennessee. And so he was the priest at the time, and he really had a huge impact on bringing my mom into the faith. And so did my mom began watching this nun, this charismatic nun on TV in the mid-1980s, who just captivated her and drew her in and made her want to learn more about the Catholic faith of her youth that she had walked away from. So she just, you know, wanted to learn everything she could. And so by the time I was born, she had a lot of passion and zeal of a faith to pass on to me. So I went to Catholic school first through eighth grade. And, but then I went to, and you know, my love as a child was in performing, and there wasn't a stage that I would see that I didn't want to get up on perform. And I would see these, boy band types on stage singing and dancing in front of thousands of screaming girls. And I was like, oh,
that's for me.
That's what I want to do. And so my people would see me dancing at family weddings and stuff like that, and they'd be like, who is that little boy in a tuxedo cutting a rug on the dance floor? and it was me. So people went up to my mom and they were like, never let that boy stop dancing. And so she signed me up for hip-hop dance classes and brought me into these classes, and like after 2 weeks they were like, we want Ryan to join our company. We want him to join our dance company to compete with us.
Oh,
and so it was me and 70 girls in middle school.
Goodness.
Oh, goodness is right. And so, we traveled and competed in the whole nine yards. And so that threw me headlong into the performing world. But you know, I was confirmed in eighth grade and, at my Catholic school, but then I went to an all-boys private school in Nashville, Tennessee, non-religiously affiliated. And I had wanted to go to this school since I was a little boy because that's where my uncle and my cousin went, and it was has an amazing reputation all throughout the Southeast for forming strong men. It's a very tough school academically and athletically and everything. The motto is gentleman, scholar, athlete. I'm talking about Montgomery wow. Bell Academy. And I always thought, you know, this is the place that's going to turn me into a man. And so I went off to this school, and it helped me tremendously in many ways because I was around a lot of really strong men, and this is where I got into performing more and more, and everything's just kind of took off from there. So there's a lot more to the story here, but it was, you know, basically I was beginning to drift away from the Catholic faith and really wasn't practicing my faith at all. And I was, you know, very successful in theater, and I was about to go off to college, which we can get to in the next segment. But, you know, this is where things started to drift away from me and my faith. So, yeah.
Well, we'll get to the rest of it because there's a good ending. Yes.
Yeah, there certainly is a whole lot more to the story, and it, you know, gets a lot better. So.
Oh, it sure does. You're listening to The Good Fight on EWTN, Global Catholic Radio Network. I'm Barbara McGuigan here with my producer, Ryan Penny. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
This is The Good Fight on EWTN Radio. For more information about The Good Fight, go to EWTN.com and click on radio. Here again is Barbara McGuigan.
Welcome back to The Good Fight. And we were left on the edges of our seats. We have Ryan Penny with us, who's telling us the rest of his story. And it did get a whole lot better. Ryan, take it away.
Yeah, so I went off to, so I got a performing arts scholarship to go to Samford University.
Great.
And, you know, this is, I was just so excited about my future. And like you said earlier, I did have aspirations to Hollywood and Broadway and everything, you know. Mm-hmm. I loved performing. That was my passion in life.
Yes.
But I kind of felt this tension between me being the superstar that I wanted to be and being the man that I wanted to become and my Catholic faith. And so as I was getting older and I was wanting to be a real man, interestingly enough, it also came with being disinterested in my faith. And I think that Jason actually put it really, really well when you were talking with him earlier, that a big problem is that men don't see the Catholic Church as a place where they want to belong, or that, you know, this is where I can be a man, because mm-hmm. they look around and they see women and children.
Yeah.
And the really strong, manly men that they see are not devout Catholics. And so I think subconsciously, that's probably what was going on. I just didn't, you know, I wanted to be all these things, and being a good holy Catholic boy just didn't really fit into that equation. And so I went off to college and at a Baptist university in the South. So my mom was kind of worried that, you know, about me, my Catholic identity there. And so there was this new Catholic Student Association that started my freshman year that ironically started my freshman year. And she was like, "Oh, honey, this is going to be great because you'll be able to have Catholic friends who can help to protect you from all the Protestants who are going to try to convert you away from the faith. And this is going to be wonderful." And I went to the student organization fair where there's this religious sister who had signups for CSA. And since my mom was there, I begrudgingly went up to this table and signed my name up and signed my name on the email list. And then I walked away and I was like, well, I'll add that to the list of things I'm never going to do. And, my freshman year, what I was interested in was performing, and all you know, I went to an all-boys high school, and there's something about the South, and especially there's something about Samford University. It's like all the beautiful women want to go there.
Really?
Which is one of the reasons that I wanted to sign up to go there, for sure. So that's, I cared about that, and I cared about fraternity, and and that's, I went to Mass maybe two times my whole freshman year, and also the temptations of college life were pulling me in a direction that I knew that wouldn't have been in agreement with what the catechism has to say about morality and the Ten Commandments. And I say that because I don't want to paint the picture that I was completely without a conscience, because I wasn't. And I also wasn't totally faithless, because I did still believe in God, and I still identified as a Catholic. I wouldn't have wanted to be anything else.
Sure.
And yet I just felt this pull between, you know, church or the world, church or the world. And I just didn't see how the church life was compelling enough. So I made my choice. But for all intents and purposes, you know, as a 19 going on 20-year-old, I was doing pretty well for the things that I set as my priorities. And my freshman year, I was cast in my first professional acting job.
Wow.
And that was going to be in that summer after my freshman year. I was in this big event at school, this singing and dancing competition at Samford called Step Sing, in which the Zeta Tau Fraternity asked me to be the only guy in their show. So again, it was like me and 70 girls, but this time performing in front of thousands of people, and as a freshman in college. So, you know,
that was big.
And on a worldly level, you ask, like, you know, does it get any better than that? And it's like, the answer is no, it doesn't. And so I got my first, you know, college girlfriend out of that whole experience. And so I thought that I was on the king of the world on many levels. But then I went to the lake with my girlfriend and her family. It's a beautiful summer day, June 2010, right after my freshman year.
Yeah.
And there's this place there called Chimney Rock. And hundreds of people jump off this rock every summer. It's like the thing to do at the lake. And certainly that day, there were hundreds of people out there on their boats and kids jumping off this thing. And I'd never really done anything like that before, so I wanted to give it a shot. I was up for the thrill of trying something new. And I march up there, and I walk up to the edge of the cliff, and I look down, and I jump. And as soon as I hit the water, there's this instant pain that just shoots up. And oh. You know, when you're up that high, you know, this is like a 60-foot cliff.
Oh,
you would think that you would go really far underneath the surface of the water.
Right.
As you're supposed to do.
Right.
But when you're up at 60 feet, water can turn into concrete.
Ooh, that's true.
So you have to be able to break the surface tension of the water.
Mm-hmm.
And I hit the water in like a seated position. So I'm in the water, and I come up out of it, and there's this shooting pain in my back.
Oh.
And this intense pain. And I look down in the water, and as I'm pumping my arms furiously, I look down in the water, and there's a problem, because I can see my legs, and I can't move them.
Oh, my goodness.
And I can't feel them. And they're just stiff, hanging there.
Ooh.
And all of a sudden, this fear, this horror just came over me. And my girlfriend was there in the water, and she had my life jacket, and she was helping me to get it on. And at that point, I didn't care at all about the pain. And all I kept saying was, I just want to know I'll be able to dance again. I just want to know that I'll be able to dance again.
Oh.
That's all I was thinking about while they were picking me up out of the water and life-flighted to UAB in Birmingham, where you know, I had a 6.5-hour surgery. And the neurosurgeon came out and told my family that Ryan is never going to walk again.
Oh, boy.
And, you know, this is the part where when I'm speaking to youth groups and stuff like that,
yeah.
When I'm actually in person, I can look down and everyone, you know, just starts to kind of chuckle because they can see quite clearly I walked into this room and I'm standing right in front of them.
Oh, praise God.
So the surgeon said, Ryan will never walk again. And Barbara, God said something else. And there's this profound change that began to happen in those days in the hospital, really starting with when I heard the surgeon tell me, "You could have died today."
That's a very sobering thing to hear. Wake up call, huh?
When you're a 20-year-old Southern frat boy cocky who thinks that he's the king of the world, that's a very sobering thing to hear and frightening thing to hear, especially when you're lying in a hospital bed paralyzed from the waist down, knowing that your first professional acting job was, the rehearsals for it were going to start in a week. And knowing that I'm probably not going to be able to make it to those rehearsals. And so I know that everything, I knew that, that chapter two of my life had just begun. And, but at the same time, you know, I was in the hospital room late at night, and everyone, because I was, you know, surrounded by so much love from my mom and my aunt and my family and friends and my girlfriend and her family, I was surrounded by love.
Yes.
And even a Catholic priest was sent to see me, a high school friend of mine, his mom, who wasn't even Catholic, made sure that she talked to my mom and made sure that a Catholic priest was sent to see me in the hospital. So even though I'd walked away from the church came to me.
Yes.
And so I was in the hospital room late at night, and everyone had done everything that they could for me, and I was just in agonizing pain. And just couldn't do anything about it. And just looking up at the ceiling, and if I had remembered anything from my Catholic education, anything that my mom had taught me growing up, it was, if you're going through a kind of suffering, offer it up.
Yeah.
And so it was like,
make it work.
Well, I have nothing else better to do, so I might as well give that a shot. And so I began to pray and cry out to God and ask for his help. In a way I never had or needed to before. And as a result of that, Barbara, I began to experience this peace and a love that came over me in those days in the hospital. And ironically, a peace and a joy that I had never known before. Even when I was up on a stage performing my best in front of thousands of people, it didn't come close to what I was beginning to experience while I was incapacitated in the hospital. So I knew that things, that this second part of my life is going to be very different. And I knew that I was convinced that I was going to walk again, and that I was going to be walking with God. And that was going to be the difference. And so, you know, I went through really intense therapy that summer, and the doctor's advice was, Ryan needs to go back to school. And I couldn't have agreed more.
Mm-hmm.
Even though my mom was a little bit apprehensive, you know, at first, it was like, Ryan needs to go back to school. He needs to be around his friends. That was really, in hindsight, the best thing for me, because they pushed me to get better. Just, you know, simply being around them, being at school, pushed me to want to get better.
Sure.
I would be in the fraternity house late at night, and I was beginning to, you know, take steps on my own with being able to take steps without having to hold on to the wall. And, you know, two steps became three steps became four. And then I had all my fraternity brothers being, you know, come on, Ryan, you can do 10 steps. You can do 10 steps. And then I did it. And turning into, by Christmas time, I didn't need the wheelchair at all anymore. And I was just using a walker. And then turned into 9 months later, in my fraternity, I was able to co-direct our own step sing show. And at the very end of it, I walked out and sang a solo with all of my fraternity brothers behind me. And no one knew that I could walk that way on my own at that point. I barely knew it. Like, it was hard. And my mom was in the audience, and, you know, everyone, you know, stood up and cheered and applauded. And it's just, you know, it was an amazing thing. But all the while, trying to be fully reconciled with the faith I had left behind, and still, like, being in the college experience, it was hard for me to, fully separate from the sins of my past. And so that was a challenge for me. And I was like, you know what, God, I think I'm beginning to realize that some of these typical college lifestyle habits that are not really providing me the happiness that I was hoping that they would. And maybe I'm wrong. So I'm open to hearing what you have to say about it. And I said, you know, I want to change, but I can't, I don't have the strength, so you're going to have to help me. And I said that prayer at home while I was looking at an image of the Divine Mercy.
Oh.
And that was one of the most sincere, honest prayers I've ever prayed in my life. And that prayer was answered about a month later when I was introduced to the thought, the genius of listening to a talk about John Paul II's theology of the body. And hearing things like, you know, the sexual revolution promised our culture so many things and ended up leaving us wanting a whole lot more. Empty promises. Yeah. And at the and in the final analysis, it basically was this. We have been trying to pull infinite satisfaction out of a finite thing.
Boy. So
and as soon as I heard those words, it pierced my soul like a spear. And because I knew that what I'd heard was the absolute truth, it was able to articulate everything that I had been experiencing. And I just took in everything that I could. I couldn't put the book down. You know, I watched and read everything that I could, about theology of the body, and guys like Jason Everett, you know, were, you know, hugely yeah. instrumental, you know, for me.
Sure.
And began watching, Father Robert Barron video, Father Robert Barron videos at the time, and was
Great.
Introducing me to videos about the faith and learning the genius of Catholicism that I'd
yes.
never really
yes.
at least paid attention to before.
Wow, sure.
And never been presented to me in that way that was so compelling. And so, you know, I threw myself headlong into the front doors of the church, even though I had been going to church every Sunday at that point.
Yeah.
There still wasn't that full interior conversion to the fullness of the faith yet. But this was making that happen. You know, the intercession of John Paul II was making that happen in my life. And so I was beginning to wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning at the fraternity house to make it to daily mass before class started.
Beautiful.
And, you know, I'm not a morning person, so that was a big deal for me.
That's a big deal.
And
beautiful.
You know, and it began to bring a like, I was in the fraternity house one night. And this was when I was really, I'd really gotten my, you know, I was going to confession regularly. I was really, my moral life was being really rehabilitated and was going to mass regularly on my own simply because I wanted to. And one night I was in a talk with my fraternity brothers and they were like, Ryan, there seems to be this peace about you that we've never seen before. And what would have, you know, solicited a bunch of, you know, frat guys to say something like that is, you know, pretty remarkable. And they weren't just talking about, oh, you're the most peaceful that we've seen you since your accident. They were talking about ever.
Oh, boy.
So, you know, that's just the beautiful paradox of the gospel that was living out and that was manifesting itself in my life. And, and I was getting back into theater, you know, but like I was still a theater major, you know, and, I was, you know, was beginning to be able to approach it in a way that I never had before. And joy was just flooding my life at that time. And so it led to me actually being a part of the Catholic Student Association that I had, you know, didn't want to have anything to do with those people when I was a freshman, you know, because
yeah.
I thought those, you know, really devout Catholics are just kind of weird and religious-y type of people. I don't want to be around them. That completely changed, and they ended up being my best friends.
Wow.
By the end of my college experience, and which launched me into, after college, getting into campus ministry, which is something I never thought that I would do.
Mm-hmm.
And now my love for my conviction and the power of media and all of that has been kind of fused together and coming full circle to working for the woman who introduced the faith to my mother, who passed it on to me, Mother Angelica, working for her now here at EWTN. And so things have really kind of come full circle for me. And God is good.
God is good. What a story. What a story, Brian. I mean, and praise God for the way you worked with him, the way you cooperated with the grace of the Holy Spirit, and the way you were willing to embrace his peace and love, just and not get caught up in what you could have easily gotten caught up in, the bitterness of your accident and everything. There's so many things where you can see God's hand in this whole thing. Mm-hmm. I'm just absolutely thrilled to learn that story. So I'm wondering how much more time we have.
We've got about 6.5 minutes left.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, good. Well, maybe you could explain your fraternus experience.
Well, see, okay, so I think a big part of the reason why I was so drawn to a place like MBA where I went to high school is because I knew that it was going to inject some much-needed testosterone in my life, you know, that it was going to help to turn me into a man. And to this day, I'm incredibly thankful for having gone to Montgomery Bell Academy.
Great.
And it really introduced me to some natural virtues that I desperately needed. And so I'm very thankful for that. And a big part of the reason why I wanted to be in a fraternity in college is because I wanted to go through an initiation experience. I wanted to
there
go through a rite of passage.
Yep. The so brotherhood. It was the brotherhood, right?
Yeah. The brotherhood. And that, like, you know, just like Sam Guzman said on the show last week, is that men want to know that they've passed the test.
Yeah.
And going through the pledgeship experience, even though it can often be a very, you know, shallow thing, it's still like you're just, you know, seeking that. And my fraternity actually had a lot more, much more wholesome elements than a lot of fraternities out there. And so that's what I wanted. And that there was a manliness there that I didn't really see that in the Catholic Church, see. I wanted these things, but I wasn't really associating that kind of a thing with Catholicism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so after my reversion, when I was coming back into the faith and I was hearing all these beautiful truths, God was beginning to bring people into my life that were showing me that what true full brotherhood looks like, what real manliness looks like, and that the things that I had been seeking after my whole life actually have their origin in the genius of Catholicism. And can only fully shine forth in the Catholic Church. And so that's when I went to my first fraternus meeting in Nashville, Tennessee, back in 2011. And I met a great guy named Jimmy Mitchell,
mm-hmm.
and who had helped to bring fraternus there. And he was just at a college guy himself, and he was mentoring all these high school boys in how to be virtuous Catholic men. And you know what? They were listening to him.
Beautiful.
And
boy,
they were wanting, and they looked up to him. And, you know, I began to think, gosh, if only I had had a little bit more of this when I was their age, you know, that this explicit, you know, sort of like how Jason was talking about how what his dad did for him on a natural level, he also have that mentorship into the supernatural. And so that's what I was seeing, what was happening in this thing called fraternus. And I knew that this was absolutely necessary. And God was, you know, introducing me to strong Catholic men as well. And fast forward a few years, and we were actually able to make fraternus come to Birmingham. And we're now going into our fifth year. And Barbara, we have 140 men who are men and boys who are a part of our chapter in Birmingham. About 120 boys and men come every single Wednesday night.
Isn't that
And it's changing these men's lives. You know, men who used to be really lukewarm in the faith and not being the leader in the home, certainly not on a spiritual level, are now leading their families in the faith. And it's changing their lives. And you know what? Their wives and their sisters and their daughters will attest to that truth. The women in their life testify to that. Yes, this is having a huge impact. Fraternus is working. And so that's why I'm a part of it.
Oh, well, they were lucky to get you, blessed, I should say, to get you. And boy, how much you have to give. And honestly, Ryan, I just see you as a true treasure of Mother Church. And I can't wait to see the heights that God intends to take you, because I really believe you've got a great future ahead of you. And just the way you were willing to be docile, you know, through all of the things that you had to go through, especially with the accident, you were docile. You were open. You were open to God's word and open to his wisdom and grace. And I just, I can't get over what, I had no idea of that part of your story. And it, so basically it was your back that was broken? Was that
really
what happened?
Yeah, my back was broken. I was paralyzed. I had a T12 spinal cord injury that was never supposed to be able to walk away from. So
he basically worked a miracle for you.
He worked a miracle in my life. That's exactly right. He worked a miracle in my life.
Goodness.
That's right. I'll end with this, because the day that I realized that I didn't need my forearm crutches anymore, I was actually at Mass in Nashville. And I was able to walk out of the church and around the parking lot up the hill to our car. And that was the first time that I was able to walk that far without the forearm crutches. That was the last day that I ever needed to use them again. And that was at Mass that I realized that.
God. Mm-hmm. Praise the Lord. Oh, my goodness. That is so wonderful. Well, thank you so much for sharing your life yourself so far. I mean, that's just beautiful.
And everyone needs to get Jason Craig's book, Leaving Boyhood Behind.
Leaving Boyhood Behind, the name of the book by Jason M. Craig. And until next week, let us continue to fight the good fight and run the race until we run right into the arms of Jesus, the perfect man, and marry his perfect mother. Bye for now.